From KQED Public Radio, this is the California Report. On today's show, what happens when anti-war demonstrations come to a military town in the California desert? The answer might surprise you. And you may not know them, but they'll probably pick the Democratic presidential nominee. We'll meet some of California's superdelegates.
My advice to both campaigns is stop lobbying me and lobby the American people about why you will make the best president and the person who's best able to lead us into the future.
Also looking for saints on the streets of L.A. and finding them on Skid Row.
You want to say it's life imitating art, but it's something quite more than that. It's where life and legend, you know, come together.
Those stories plus how a Colombian folk music band has young Angelenos on their feet. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is the California Report. It's been a week of protests and remembrances. The fifth anniversary of the Iraq War ignited passion on all sides of the issue. Support for the war in California is often strong around military bases, where soldiers and their families are part of the community fabric. The small Mojave Desert town of 29 Palms is home to the nation's biggest Marine Corps base, but residents there will hold a peace vigil next week. A few years ago, that would have been unthinkable in a town that reveres its Marines. But as the war goes on, a grassroots peace movement is gradually gaining acceptance and adding new recruits. From KPCC, Stephen Cuevas reports.
When you oppose a war in the middle of a military town, you're begging for trouble. Just ask Ray Noel.
I did one time yell at this Republican, Bush is killing our troops, and it got into the local newspaper, and of course my daughter knows me, and I, Mother, did you do that? And I said, yes, I did, because that's Bush is killing our troops.
The elderly Noel moved here from Santa Barbara 6 years ago. In the weeks leading up to the invasion of Iraq, she organized her first peace vigil. A few dozen people turned up, but there was a backlash. Some called her a traitor. Her car was vandalized. Noel lost her job with the city. It made the news.
Why? His answer, the rally conflicts with the beliefs of the Chamber of Commerce.
We'll probably send the wrong message to the troops that we're back here trying to support.
It's frustrating for me because I can't be out there on the street corner. This town is just different.
When somebody would tell me that I'm not supporting the troops, I'd figuratively grab them in the neck and say, don't say I've never supported the troops. I slept in the holes with them.
Lutheran pastor and former Marine chaplain Joe Matouche is the only clergyman in the 29 Palms area to openly express opposition to the war.
Well, our church's name is Prince of Peace Lutheran Church. I wanted people to know that not everybody in 29 Palms was drooling blood.
Matouche organizes an annual candlelight vigil for troops killed in Iraq. More people turn out each year, while counter-demonstrators have dwindled. But activism has cost him parishioners.
And they feel that if we say no more war, that we're going to demoralize our troops and they're going to feel like, you know. And as we see now, many of the military are questioning as well.
29 Palms barely existed before the U.S. Marines settled in 50 years ago. Today, around 15,000 people live here, mostly active duty and retired Marines and their families. If you live in town, chances are you have a connection. The base and nearby Marine Hospital are the town's largest employers, and there are dozens of tattoo parlors, barber shops, and other stores that rely on Marine business.
You don't bite the hand that feeds you, and it really bothers us when people do come into town and raise hell and try to make a stink of it.
Vietnam veteran Dan O'Brien leans against his pickup truck in the front yard of his home on 29 Palms Highway. The self-described conservative gadfly is protective of the young men and women in uniform and their families.
In this town, it just isn't socially acceptable to drag them through an emotional turmoil over pro-war, anti-war, so we just basically kind of quietly talk within ourselves. And if we get so bound up in politics, we lose the fact that we are community.
Musician Ted Quinn moved here from Los Angeles around 10 years ago.
Why are all the wives looking so sad? She was just a child herself, with a child beneath the bed. Now she's stuck without the only friend she had.
Quinn opposes the war, though many of his friends are Marines. Some have died or been wounded in combat, so he understands how anti-war sentiment can sting. He still speaks out, but with those friends in mind.
Well, I hope it doesn't hurt their feelings, because it's definitely not intended to attack them personally or, you know, as soldiers or anything else. I mean, we want those guys to come home, and we want them to come home alive. So I don't think that they're offended by that.
How does anyone ever win a war anyhow?
Some people in 29 Palms say as the war in Iraq enters its sixth year, fewer and fewer people line the streets to welcome returning troops. Fewer flags are hung from houses and storefront windows. 29 Palms councilman Steve Spear says the town is hurting.
Now, that is not that they don't support our troops. I believe there are none. There's nothing people can do. I mean, how many times are you going to go out and welcome them home as heroes? It's not ending.
Spear is a retired Marine major. He has three children on active duty. His eldest, Mike, just won the Bronze Star for Valor on the battlefield in Iraq. He's now showing possible signs of post-traumatic stress disorder. After months of effort, Mike and another brother, who's serving in Afghanistan, convinced their youngest brother not to enlist. That severs a family tradition that goes back to the Spanish-American War. Steve Spear says the family, including his boys in combat, opposed the war in Iraq.
There comes a time in everybody's life where you're faced with some kind of moral decision. People are trying to define those people as being not supportive of the troops. That's moronic to apply that to me. I mean, my son will do what he's told to do. They're going to fight for this country, whether they believe in the cause or not. Nobody is spitting on our troops, calling them names when they come home. The people of America support our troops.
Councilman Spear may ask the city of 29 Palms to adopt a resolution officially opposing the war in Iraq. But first, he wants to see what the next president can do about bringing the troops home to stay. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas in 29 Palms.
The Iraq War is one of several issues driving up voter turnout in this year's presidential campaign. So far, more than 25 million Americans have cast their votes in the Democratic presidential primaries and caucuses alone. But when all the voting is done, neither Barack Obama nor Hillary Clinton is likely to have enough pledged delegates to win the nomination. And so, in the end, it will probably be up to some 800 Democratic Party insiders, the superdelegates, to put one of them over the top. California has 71 superdelegates, more than any other state, and they're being watched like rats in a clinical trial.
It's something else, I tell you. It really is intense.
That's Ed Espinoza, one of the 20 or so superdelegates from California whose vote is still up for grabs. He supported New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson in the California primary. Richardson endorsed Obama Friday, but Espinoza is holding firm, still uncommitted. He's been called by Bill Clinton twice, and several U.S. senators have lobbied on behalf of Obama. So, how's he holding up under all that pressure?
All of that is nice. It's impressive. It's flattering. But I think that I would be less of a representative if the allure of a call like that actually did influence how I was going to vote. I think I need to base it on more substantial means.
The 35-year-old PR consultant from Long Beach is one of the rank-and-file party activists elected to the Democratic National Committee. Espinoza says there's a misconception that superdelegates are a bunch of Ivy League-educated elites, and that people are surprised to learn that he is one of them.
They don't expect that it's a guy who went to a state university, you know, who rents, who doesn't own, and is just a regular guy that they identify with.
Of course, not all the superdelegates are exactly average. In fact, half the ones from California are members of Congress, and they lean heavily toward Senator Clinton. One of the undecided Congress members is San Diego Democrat Bob Filner, who seems to enjoy having so much power.
I go around San Diego with a Superman cape and a T-shirt that just to make sure people know the status of super delegate that I am. And
can you leap tall buildings in a single bound?
I'm going to try in the next time I'm out with my cape.
Congress members like Filner are facing a bundle of competing pressures. Filner says he's still evaluating both candidates. And remember, superdelegates by their nature can vote for whomever they want.
you know, I think most of us are going to be looking at who can win and who can carry the majority of the House and the Senate with them.
You know, you say you talk to the candidates all the time, and I can imagine Hillary Clinton saying, come on, Bob, look, 59-60% of your constituents voted for me. What are you waiting for?
And that's exactly what she said.
Another uncommitted superdelegate is Christine Pelosi, daughter of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Talking at an outside cafe in San Francisco, Christine Pelosi says she's waiting until all the primaries are over. Whoever has the most elected delegates at that point will win her support.
If they can survive this Byzantine process with the most delegate votes, then in my mind, that's the person who has passed the fitness test for president that we, the Democratic Party, set up.
Christine Pelosi, whose book Campaign Boot Camp is a politics 101 primer for party activists, says Democrats should never hand the nomination to someone who did not win the most delegates.
I can't imagine going home after the Denver convention here to California and saying, let's start a phone bank and tell people that they should get out the vote and that their vote will count when we've just decided that it didn't.
Some of the superdelegates I reached didn't want to talk. One of them hung up when I told him I was a reporter. Others, like retired schoolteacher Alita Huguenin from Rancho Murrieta near Sacramento, seemed happy to talk. She's leaning toward Senator Clinton, but says she's getting all kinds of pressure, some of it pretty unconventional.
One person did a whole thing on numerology that sent it to me on why it was that I absolutely, in astrological signs and stuff, of why it absolutely had to be Obama. That's an interesting point of view. I'll take that under consideration. I'll look at my horoscope that day.
California Democratic Party Chair Art Torres says despite the increasingly harsh tone between Clinton and Obama, the seemingly endless race has mostly increased voter interest in the Democrats.
But there is a point at which you cross from excitement into danger.
The danger, Torres says, is that John McCain will get to define himself and his opponent while Democrats are busy battling one another. Still, Torres dismisses talk about the nomination being determined at the convention in late August. He insists superdelegates will pledge their support for either Clinton or Obama in early June, as soon as Democrats are done voting.
Every superdelegate that I've spoken to across the country, I think there is a consensus in this issue, and that is they do not want to go against the will of the primaries and the caucuses, number one. Number two, they want a candidate that can win in the general, and that seems to coincide with who's won the most delegates from the primaries and the caucuses.
In the meantime, both campaigns will continue their full-court press, to which superdelegate Christine Pelosi says this.
My advice to both campaigns is stop lobbying me and lobby the American people about why you will make the best president and the person who's best able to lead us into the future.
Every superdelegate said they want the nomination wrapped up in June and predicted it would be. But then, almost all the predictions about this year's presidential campaign so far have been wrong. Los Angeles has 103 streets named after saints, from St. Andrew's Place to Santa Ynez Street. For the past 8 years, artist J. Michael Walker has researched and traveled to each and every one of them. What he found were parallel stories and lives of the saints and the people now living on streets named after them. His new book, All the Saints of the City of the Angels, interprets these connections through paintings, stories, and poetry. Walker says the project was inspired by a map.
I was needing to go somewhere, and in the pre-MapQuest days, I was using this book of maps we all referred to, the Thomas Guide. I was looking up a street in the index, began with the letter S. I didn't recall it anymore, but I got distracted, as I'm wont to do as an artist, by columns of streets whose names had names like Santa Monica Boulevard, San Pedro Street, St. Louis Street. And it was the first time it really hit me that we live in a culture and in a geography where there are so many places named for saints. So the phrase hit me, all of the saints of the City of the Angels. And I thought, I knew enough of early California history to know that Spanish explorers and Mexican settlers would name places for saints, with a hope and expectation the saint would have some positive impact on the place bearing her or his name. I also recognized there couldn't be 2,500 streets that date from the time of the Mexicans and the Spanish explorers. So most of these streets were named not by Mexicans or Spaniards, but by Anglo real estate developers.
Did that sort of break the romantic notion for you as you got into the history?
Actually, that made it far more compelling to me because one had this sense that the people who came in and sort of erased, shall we say, in a nice way, the cultures that were pre-existing when the railroads came in the 1870s and 1880s, then began to think, you know, there was actually something romantic about that. So people would name streets for saints in Spanish without any knowledge really of the culture or of who the saints were. So that actually became the really interesting thing, was not to know why somebody named it for a saint, but to see how the story and legend of the saint comments on what's happened in the street.
One of the first streets that you write about in the book and visited, in fact, as part of this project, is San Julian Street, which is in the heart of Skid Row, downtown Los Angeles. In your mind, how did the image of San Julian and the reality of life on Skid Row, how did those two things intersect when you went out there?
Well, I was really struck by the convergence of these two stories, the history of San Julian Street and the legend of San Julian. San Julian is the patron saint of wanderers and those who give refuge to wanderers. San Julian Street, since the mid-80s, has become the central gathering place for the city's homeless population and therefore has become the place where most of the clinics serving the homeless are located. So it was extraordinary to see how these two came together. You want to say it's life imitating art, but it's something quite more than that. It's where life and legend, you know, come together. And by going to San Julian Street, meeting up with and conversing with the homeless and engaging them and them agreeing to pose for me as contemporary San Julians, one of the things that I think happens in the process of beginning to portray the homeless as San Julian is that it allows us to confer a degree of humanity / divinity on people who are just engaged in this term that we used, homeless, you know.
You went throughout Los Angeles, from some of the ritziest areas to places like Skid Row, downtown. What were some of the more unlikely pairings of names and places that you found?
Well, a world away from San Julian Street in both income and geography is San Isidro Drive in Bel Air. And it's named for a poor Spanish farmer, day laborer really, who had to hire out to work in the lands of the wealthy to support his family. When I drove out to San Isidro Drive, which arcs north of Sunset Boulevard off of Benedict Canyon, the only people I saw in a midweek morning were Mexican day laborers, essentially living the life of San Isidro on San Isidro Drive. I kind of slapped my forehead and got out and approached one of the gardeners who was interested to see what I was doing. I explained that I'm an artist and I'm doing a project about all the streets named for saints, and we're talking in Spanish, of course, and I'm asking him if he knows which street this is, and of course, San Isidro Drive, and you know who San Isidro is? Well, of course. And I mentioned to him, I thought that he was, in essence, a contemporary San Isidro, and he kind of smiled and chuckled and shook his head in assent, and I asked him if he would pose for me as a contemporary San Isidro, and he asked, like this, in my denim shirt and holding a rake, and I said, exactly like that. And I think that the convergence of myth and legend and reality and that portrait that I was able to create convey everything I want to say about the strength, the humility, and yet also the dignity of manual labor.
I'm wondering if you've heard it all from the Catholic Church in Los Angeles.
You know, it's interesting about that. When I began the project, I was very careful not to approach the Catholic Church because I wanted to be clear that this is not a Catholic project with a capital C. It's Catholic with a lowercase c. It's all embracing. It's all welcoming. And I didn't want people from other cultures to feel that this was not for them. What I found is by continuing that approach over the years, that now I'm finding that the Catholic Church in Los Angeles, the Archdiocese, is warmly welcoming this project. In fact, we hope to install a satellite version of the project at the Fine Arts Gallery at the Cathedral in downtown Los Angeles later this year.
Hmm. So this book, you've been working on this project for 8 years, kind of a spiritual geography of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, you know, now that you're toward the end of the project, what did it teach you about the soul of Los Angeles, the spirit of Los Angeles?
What it's really conveying on some level is that all the saints are all the people around us. If we're able to recognize the full scope of humanity of the people around us, if we begin, in essence, just to sort of cut each other a little bit of slack, that sort of conferring divinity upon everyone and upon ourselves, that we are each the saints for the person next to us.
J. Michael Walker is author of All the Saints of the City of the Angels, Seeking the Soul of L.A. on Its Streets, published by Heyday Books. Paintings and stories from the book will be on exhibit at the Autry Museum of the American West in Los Angeles through September 7th. J. Michael Walker, thanks so much for sharing your project with us.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And you can see some of the artwork from J. Michael Walker's book. Just check out a link at our website. It's californiareport.org. Two brothers in Los Angeles are taking some traditional folk music and making it hip for a new generation of fans. The LA-based group Very Be Careful performs its own version of Colombian vallenato music. Madeline Baer has more.
So how's everybody feeling on tonight? Good? All right.
It's a quarter past midnight in Hollywood, and a few hundred Angelinos fill the dance floor of a club called Safari Sam's. The all-ages crowd, peppered with mohawks, dreadlocks, and fishnet stockings, epitomizes the diversity of young L.A. But the first three clangs of a cowbell transport this trendy club to northern Colombia. The man on stage with the cowbell wears an air of mystery with his dark wraparound shades and gelled black hair. The accordionist sits in front of him, dripping with sweat. While he squeezes and pulls his instrument, he holds his head against it as if listening for a heartbeat. Judging by the wave of movement on the dance floor, there's certainly a beat. As for a heart, accordionist Ricardo Guzman says that's what this music is all about.
It's like, you know, you put your heart into it and it's like it'll pay you back somehow, you know.
Guzman and his brother and bass player Arturo sit outside the club before the show, listing the ways their band Very Be Careful has rewarded them. Six albums, the world tours, and the loyal Los Angeles following aren't typical for a band playing obscure folk music. The style they play, vallenato, may sound foreign, but the Guzman brothers picked up the rhythms not far from here, in their downtown L.A. childhood home. Their Colombian parents brought their vinyl collection with them when they immigrated.
We would hear it as kids, like, you know, at parties and at our house from our parents, you know.
The music comes from a mix of ethnic influences in northern Colombia. According to legend, a shipwrecked German freighter washed hundreds of accordions onto the Colombian shore. Add a cumbia rhythm, the indigenous scraper or guacharaca, and a small African drum, and you have a recipe for the funky sound of vallenato. Like many boys did back in Colombia, Ricardo began accordion school at a young age. 10 years ago, his brother Arturo, who also played music, had a proposition for him.
He's like, look, I play bass, you play accordion. That's part of, you know, the music. You know, we need to get some percussion players, and we got a band.
With the addition of three percussionists, Very Be Careful was born. The band has cultivated a sound that evokes long, sunny afternoons in Colombian towns.
Beach style, like, you know, you're from the coast, kicking back with, like, your drinking shirt and your shorts, having a good time.
Spanish lyrics tell simple tales. Girls that don't stay, dogs that don't leave, buses that never come.
Could be like, hey, guess what? I went to the store and they carded me and they didn't want to give me a drink. So I went and I did something else to try and achieve what I needed to do. And like, it's not a story that's so like exciting that you can make a movie about it, but you can definitely make a song about it.
The stories may be ordinary, but the band's unbridled energy pours out of their songs like beer from the tap at their live shows. Yolanda Ugarte now packs a handheld fan in her purse for their gigs.
It's good, the energy, like in the crowd, you're just like, oh my god, keep going, keep going. It's just like everyone dances.
Ugarte has seen the band ejected from their own concerts after playing past closing time. She explains the crossover success of Very Be Careful when she calls the band punk rock. It's not a reference to their music, which remains faithful to the traditional vallenato style, but to their approach, a rebellious one that audiences from LA dive bars to hip art galleries can appreciate.
Wonderland!
On Sunset Boulevard, it's now 1 a.m, and the rhythm of vallenato has kept the dance floor in motion for almost an hour. When the man in the shades announces the group is done with their warm-up, it looks like it's going to be a late night. For the California Report, I'm Madeline Baer.
We are very successful!
And that's our show for today. The California Report is a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is the technical producer, with engineering help from Howard Gelman and Danny Bringer. Our online editor is Gabriel Cohen. Our interns are June Stinson, Ali Tabatabai, Harry Gregory, and Leanne Lucetta. The producers are Erica Kelly and Victoria Maleone. The senior producer is Ingrid Becker. Our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Hope you have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the Wesley Foundation for coverage of immigration issues throughout California, the California Teachers Association, because every child deserves a chance to learn and no child succeeds alone. More information is available at cta.org, and the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, rating hospital quality in California. On the web at calhospitalcompare.org.